Good evening. Back there at Towson and here at the Washington Center of the University of California. We have another in our series of conversations and discussions on the White House and the press from the viewpoint of reporters and officials. And today we have Maura Reynolds, who is White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. And when he gets here, we're going to have Bob Deans of Cox Newspapers, who is a White House correspondent as well. Maura has worked on the White House beat for the last year and a half, and so we're going to talk right off about the other places where she has been assigned and the what she's enjoyed about the White House beat and a comparison with other places that that she's worked. So Maura, review your career before you came to the White House. It's often a shock for reporters when they come to the White House because it's not the free-ranging beat that people expect it to be, that you're confined to in a physical location, and also you're confined in the amount of information that's provided to you. Did you find that, and how did it compare with the beats that you had been before?
Very much so. First of all, can you guys hear me okay? Yes? Before I came to the White House a year and a half ago, I was based in Russia for 6 years. And going from being a foreign correspondent to being a White House correspondent was like night and day. I covered 15 countries, 11 or 13 or something of the world's time zones, got to go to war zones, covered everything from lengthy features to breaking front page news, you know, just an enormous variety of stories. And then I come here and my major duty is to show up and sit in a very cramped space and listen to what often seems like blather for a lot of the day. I described it when I first came as I suddenly felt like veal kept in the dark and force-fed. So before I was in Russia, just, you know, my background a little bit more, I worked for the AP for about 5 years on both in Russia and on their international news desk in New York. And before that, I worked in Los Angeles for the AP and for a number of years as a education reporter at the San Diego Union-Tribune. So,
well, in looking at the kinds of things that you did in Russia, what would be a normal week in the kinds of stories that you would do there, and how does that vary with what you do at the White House?
Well, I shared the Moscow beat with a number of other reporters, and we had this system where we were basically on daily responsibility and then off daily responsibility sort of for a week at a time. So on my weeks when I was the daily reporter, I would handle any breaking news that came up that week. And it often meant I wrote 3 or 4 daily stories in that week, and it could be from anywhere, and I was almost always in Moscow, doing it in Moscow. On the weeks when I was on Enterprise, I could go anywhere, and it meant that when I traveled, I would usually plan it for a week at a time, and you would go to some remote area of Russia or something interesting and do it lengthy and do it well. And you would take, you know, I might do 2 stories out of a week-long trip, or maybe only 1 if it was a really good one. And occasionally we did trips longer than that as well. At the White House, there's this sort of numbing daily routine of, you know, cycle of briefings and a very grueling travel schedule. And because of the travel schedule, where we travel 2 or 3 times a week, and then sometimes for stretches of, you know, 4 or 5 days or a week on the road, my partner on the beat and I trade it off. You know, so one person does one trip, I do the next trip. That, you know, he does the next, we just basically leapfrog each other. And the problem with that is that we can't ever really plan anything. I don't have nice discrete blocks of time to devote to covering something that needs to be done. And, you know, even just this week, there's a feature story that I'm working on, and my editors wanted me to spend last week doing it and most of this week doing it. But then all of a sudden today I had to get involved in daily coverage, and, you know, the schedule came out, and there's all this other stuff going on this week. And I'll be lucky if I get one day this week to work on this feature story, which is supposed to be a priority. So it makes it very, very hard to plan and to focus on a worthy topic that you want to focus on.
Mm-hmm. What would be an enterprise story, say, when you were in Russia? What kind of enterprise story? Can you give us some examples of a couple of them, and then give us a couple of examples of enterprise stories that you've done on the White House and how you went about, in each case, getting information?
Oh, God, I mean, it's just not even comparable. Let's see. Come up with a few examples.
Well, when you're traveling to far corners of Russia, what were some of the places you went to and the kinds of stories you developed?
Okay. Well, for instance, I did take a week once to go to a little place called Nagorno-Karabakh, which is a self-declared autonomous region between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and I spent a couple of days there talking to people, and what you get in a place like that is a mood. You might talk to the foreign minister or the president of the, you know, alleged country of Nagorno-Karabakh, but you also spend a lot of time talking to people and seeing how they live and going into their houses, and just sort of experiencing the place, you know, seeing where they get their food, you know, checking the labels on the toothpaste in the market stalls, and what does that tell you about where their goods are coming from, and that kind of thing. It's a very tangible, real, in-your-face kind of experience. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the really special things about being in Russia, was that you really could experience things that, you know, were real people's lives in places that other people very rarely went. On the White House, it's very, very difficult to come up with an enterprise or feature story. I spent a good week last year working on a story about the president's use of religious language in his mm-hmm. speeches. And that's the kind of thing that passes for enterprise, is dissecting the president's speeches more in depth than you normally do. Uh-huh. I did a story on Condoleezza Rice and on her role in the administration, what she was doing that was good, what some members of the administration, especially in other departments like the State Department and the Defense Department, whether they thought she was doing her job well or not. And it turns out, you know, those stories, you wind up talking to a lot of people, often on background or off the record, and it winds up being a so-and-so said, then so-and-so said the opposite, then so-and-so said this third thing. And so it doesn't have the same feel that there are real people and real places mm-hmm. at stake, and that's a real problem.
When you were in Nagorno-Karabakh, did you find that people would talk to you, that say the foreign minister or any of the people in the government?
Yes.
Were they pretty free?
Oh, yeah. They were usually dying to talk to you. Uh-huh. I mean, and that's, I mean, the biggest problem with the White House is that you really feel like your calls don't get returned. That there are very few people who you're allowed to talk to, and when you do get to talk to them, they say very little, and this is a completely new experience. I mean, one of the reasons my editors joke that one of the reasons why they decided to bring me back from Russia to cover this administration was that I had experience covering the Kremlin. I'm here to tell you that it was easier to cover the Kremlin than it was to cover this administration. And the main difference I find is that the Russians at least were upfront about when they weren't going to talk to you and when they weren't going to tell you something. And this administration tries to say that they've told you something and that they've communicated about something or they've answered your question, when in fact they haven't. And that's a very big difference.
Are there ways of going outside of the institution, outside of the White House, outside of the presidency, to get answers?
Yeah, there is, but it's And you can get some things that way, but one of the other problems with this administration is that information is very, very tightly held. So even when you go outside of this administration to the people that they talk to, sometimes those people will be up to date as of a week or 10 days ago, but they're not the decision makers themselves. Mm-hmm. And so if things have changed in the interim, you can't always be certain. Or you can't, you know, you're definitely taking secondary information at that point. And the decision makers are very much out of reach.
Mm-hmm. How difficult is it to come into Washington after covering Russia for 6 years and establish the kinds of contacts that you need to cover a White House?
It's not easy. It's not easy. I mean, this is a town that works very much on who you know and also on tracking people, where they've been. A lot of White House reporters have come up through Congress. Mm-hmm. And so they know issues from they know which people are point people on various issues on the Hill. Some of those wind up coming into administrations when they change. There's sort of, you know, they keep track of each other over the years in different jobs. And my editors were actually understood that was a liability for me, was that I was coming in to a beat in Washington, a central beat in Washington, without having spent any time doing other things in Washington. But mm-hmm. But information is so closely held in this administration anyway that, you know.
Are there advantages, though, to coming in from outside?
Well, you try to make it an advantage, you know, by calling people up and saying, well, you know, I'm really new at this. Can you take a little time to explain this to me? So you do try to in that sense, as a reporting tack, you can make it try to work for your advantage. But in some ways, you do see things differently. I mean, especially early on, I found that when the whole debate about the Iraq War was going on, that my experience having lived in Europe was that I really saw the debate over Iraq differently than my colleagues did, and that was a very interesting dynamic.
What did you see?
I'm trying to remember now some specifics. I'm not recalling anything in particular, but you know, some of the inconsistencies in the administration's argument, I think, were more glaringly obvious to me, or at least I wasn't willing, mm-hmm. I was less willing to accept them at face value. I can give you one example. One thing that to this day actually drives me crazy, and really drove me crazy when I was overseas, was the administration's use of the term war on terror. I don't know how many of you guys have studied national security, but officially, you can't fight a war on terror. Terror is, by definition, a tactic, not an enemy. That kind of logical, you know, disconnect really struck me, because what the administration did rhetorically by naming this thing the War on Terror was lump a bunch of disparate groups of people together and made the threat seem, number one, very large and very poorly defined, when in fact some people, especially in Europe, would have seen discrete sets of issues that maybe required different approaches. Mm-hmm. So I refused for many months to use the term war on terror because I thought it was imprecise, and I tried to be very specific, you know, talk about Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, not lump everything together, Saddam Hussein separately. But eventually you realize that the public has accepted this terminology and it means something in their minds. And when it becomes a rhetorical reality, you can try to be as precise as you want in certain ways, but when you're writing stories about rhetoric or when you're describing arguments that the administration is making, you can't completely avoid the use of their rhetoric. And so, you know, that was a difference. I think that there was very little resistance in this country to the use of that term after September 11th because of the shock of being here and experiencing that. But overseas, people, I think, are still scratching their heads saying, what is the war on terror?
When the president just talks about himself as a wartime president, do you think that as more casualties mount in Iraq, that people are going to see that as a war with Iraq rather than a war on terror, and that that has some disadvantages for them because it is not quite as popular as I think, as you know, as the casualties mount, as perhaps a general war on terror.
Well, that's an obvious liability for them, especially in the election year.
Mm-hmm. When you came into the White House, did the press secretary or the communications chief round up any of the new reporters and take you to meet the president?
Eventually, it took a few months. But after I was there for about 4 or 5 months, there were about 5 or 6 of us who had started on the beat in the previous 6 months, and they brought us in for a private, off-the-record session, get to know you with the president. It lasted about 45 minutes or so, and it was the first time I'd really had a chance to talk to him.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that he was different in private than in public?
In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. One of the things people always say about this president is that he's much more personable in person than he is in public and in his persona, that he's the kind of guy you can kind of, you know, sit down around a picnic table with and you know, kind mm-hmm. of share chit-chat. That is true up to a point. He's not really terribly comfortable with journalists generally. And one thing that I have noticed, I've done a number of sessions with him, you know, small roundtable interviews, and I find that at the beginning of the interview, he's very much on his guard, and his defenses are really up, and it was the same in this private session in the Oval Office that we had with him. And then as he warms up, he eventually, you see this personable side that the people who work for him always talk about and that his supporters always talk about, that he's, you know, he likes to be an ordinary guy and sort of converse about real things, and he holds his views, you know, very sincerely and very firmly. And he comes across as very genuine, and that's something that's hard to see in him necessarily behind the podium, but it is something that you see in person. You know, regardless of what you think of him as a person, he does come across as a very genuine person after a while.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, generally that's true, though. The sense one gets of him is of a person whose views are strongly held. And
yes.
And somebody that that enjoys dealings, I guess, particularly with certain kinds of people. Like, for example, when sports figures are there,
yes.
He clearly is a guy who likes sports. When the Hall of Famers were there for a baseball event, it was clear how much he was a fan. I remember a pool report, I think, that you wrote from a session in Air Force One.
Mm-hmm.
That was it coming back from the Middle East?
It would have been while we were in the Middle East.
Pool reports are reports that come from a print person writes that is on a particular rotation where everybody can't go into a small space. But they're going to allow a certain number of reporters in, and so it's a established list of rotating where there's a radio reporter, their television, their all the wires are in, and there's a magazine person and a print person, and the print person writes up the event sometimes with the magazine person, and those reports have to give people a feel for that are not there. A feel for what the event was like, what the place looked like, what the president was like, how he was dressed, but really capture the feel for him, whether he was relaxed, whether he was tight, all of that sort of thing. And because the other reporters have to be able to write their stories from that pool report. And Maura writes, I think you write just, you're among the best in writing pool reports.
Well, thank you.
when you're doing a pool report, what are some of the things that you're trying to capture?
Well, you're trying to look for the things that aren't going to be clear in the transcript. So I tend not to be worrying about writing down every word that the president says. What I look for is the setting, and I look for his demeanor, and you know, try to note details that would give a sense of you know, I guess the atmosphere. I mean, I remember the Air Force One interview in the Middle East. He just had what he thought was a very, very big foreign policy success in getting the Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers to sign on to the roadmap for peace. And, of course, a few months later, that was all up in smoke. But at the time, it seemed like a very big deal. And they invited us forward to the front of Air Force One, to the president's private quarters. That had not been done. That was the very first time that had been done in his presidency. And we were all very taken aback. And I realized that there was going to be a transcript. They're going to do a transcript of his remarks. But what they weren't going to do is describe how he was sitting, you know, what he was wearing. You know, he still had on his dress shirt, but he'd taken off his tie. You know, it was a very fancy dress shirt. You know, it wasn't a button sleeved. It was, you know, French cuffs. And mm-hmm. you know, what did he, you know, they offered us all drinks. Actually, not everything gets out into the transcript because they only start the transcript when he begins talking. So all of the chit-chat in the room in the beginning mm-hmm. and all the chit-chat afterwards doesn't get on there. And he's really big on chit-chat. So there's, you know, all of this sort of banter first about what we wanted to drink and you know, and then what he drank. You know, he went through a couple of Diet Cokes and whatever. And that's all stuff that you really wouldn't have a sense of. And also I tried to remember what his gestures were. I remember there was one time during it that he, you know, banged his fist on the table. And that's not going to be in the transcript either. And so you try to, you know, remember and mark down those details because they really give a sense of the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because other reporters are certainly going to use it.
Well, the whole theory of the Pool Report is that everybody who wants and deserves to be there can't be there for physical constraints, reasons of physical constraints. So there's one representative of each of the major types of news organization. And you're basically being a reporter, not just for you, but for all of them. So I'm representing all 45 newspapers or whatever it is when I'm on pool duty. And so I have to think and act not just for my story, but for what all the other stories might want and might want to say. And so I do approach my pool duties differently than I approach writing mm-hmm. my own stories. I'm much more comprehensive, for instance, because I don't know what details or questions will be most interesting to some of my colleagues, mm-hmm. you know, so.
Uh-huh. Like, for example, the tabs might be interested in, you know, certain kind of, like, the decor.
Right,
Something like that. When you're writing your own stories, do you have in mind a particular type of reader? Do you have an image of who you're writing for?
I tend to think of that my readers are intelligent. And that they follow what I write. And so I'm in a kind of a dialogue with them. And that I'm trying to tell them what I see and give them some guidance as to different ways they might want to think about what's going on. What I think is the relevant background. What I think are the interesting new details or not. And I do think about... I think I imagine more or less a someone who takes the time to read the newspaper every day, someone who's mm-hmm. probably in their 50s or 60s and has been around the block a few times and takes this all very seriously, and who's going to call me to task if I get anything wrong or I slip mm-hmm. over the line from analysis to opinion. And I think maybe the reason I have this image is that I get letters from exactly that kind of person. You know, I mean, I get letters and emails, and this gives me a sense of who the people are who actually do pay attention to what I write. You know,
how many emails would you get? Like, say, over a weekend when you open up your computer on a Monday, how many emails would you have from readers?
Actually, it's very inconsistent. It depends very much on the story. I was surprised that. The National Guard issue, this question of whether Bush actually fulfilled his National Guard duties, I got more email on that one story than I had on any other story I'd done in the last year, including the war on Iraq.
What were the viewpoints?
I got a lot of letters from people who said, actually, I got a lot of letters from military, people who were serving in the military around the country, a lot of retired military, National Guard officers, and a consistent theme, and I'm not saying that these are a majority of the people who serve in the military or even in the National Guard, but I would say a majority of the people who took the time to write me or call me were people who would describe themselves as not liking flag-waving draft dodgers. That's a direct quote from one of them, you know, that they found it because they had served. They found that their view was that the president was hypocritical in the way that he promoted the military but avoided fulfilling all of his responsibilities to the military when he was during the Vietnam period.
Did you find that there was any consistency in the mail? Did you think that maybe there was some kind of email campaign?
No, it definitely wasn't, because the people were from very different parts of the country, and they said very different kinds of things. And a lot of the email, actually, I mean, this is how I know it wasn't a campaign, was a lot of them were trying to give me hints as to how to figure it out. You know, like, well, when I was serving in this place, you know, we had to fill out our pay slips this way. So you should, you know, look, you know, go pull the records from this place and check the pay slips, you know. And or I think that, you know, the documents would be in this place. And they were actually, you know, trying to help me, you know, find places to look, to dig up information. So that's not the kind of letter that you get when there's an orchestrated campaign.
Yeah. That brings me to where your readers are. That since your paper, the Los Angeles Times, is set in Los Angeles, one would assume that most of your readers are in Los Angeles, except that your service takes the paper and takes your stories throughout the country. Do you hear from people throughout the country, or is it mostly Los Angeles?
No, I get letters from all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how many papers carry a story?
No, we don't. I mean, we try every so often to figure it out, because we're always trying to remind the White House that the LA Times in particular has this problem. We're a national newspaper, but we're also a regional newspaper, and they're never really quite sure which way to treat us. And sometimes it means we get double access, sometimes it means we get none. We're constantly trying to remind them that we really are a national newspaper, because I probably have as many readers outside of California as I do have inside California. The LA Times is owned by the Chicago Tribune, and the Chicago Tribune owns a whole bunch of newspapers around the country, including a large number in Florida, which in terms of political calculus, this administration tends to think that California is sort of a lost cause for Republicans, but we have a large number of readers in Florida, and that is a very important state to the Republicans. So we're constantly trying to remind them that I'm not just the White House reporter for the Los Angeles Times. I'm the White House reporter for the Orlando Sentinel, for a whole bunch of other Florida newspapers, for a lot of papers in the Midwest, you know, and it's probably as many, and that's not even counting the number of people who get the Los Angeles Times, Washington Post news service, which is a news service that we put out like the New York Times news service. And so papers that aren't owned by the Chicago Tribune Company still run my stuff. I had a friend who lived in Macon, Georgia, and the paper in Macon, which is owned by Knight Ridder, used to print my stuff constantly. And I was just astonished. And I get letters from all sorts of odd places around the country. I didn't even know that they've got newspapers. So you never really can be sure anymore where your stuff shows up.
In Elizabeth Buemiller's interview with the First Lady was trying to knock down the story that the president doesn't read newspapers. And she indicated that was the first thing they did in the morning, that they would read five newspapers. Was the Los Angeles Times one of those newspapers?
I sure as hell hope so. It ought to be.
When you went into journalism, why did you choose it as a career? What did you see as the rewards from it, and has it turned out?
My choice was basically, I was a Russian major in college, and I went back to grad school for Russian studies after I'd worked as a journalism for a couple of years. And the alternative for me of if I hadn't become a reporter, I probably would have become a historian. And I thought long and hard about that change, that choice at one part in my life. And I think that actually reporters and historians have a lot in common. You know, you're interested in the course of history, you're interested in what moves events, and, you know, one of the old saws about journalism is that it's the first draft of history, and there's something mm-hmm. to that. The main reason why, as much as I loved studying Russian history, that I decided not to do that and to go into to go with journalism is that I really just didn't want to write about nothing but Russian history for the rest of my life. And there's so many interesting places in the world. And one of the wonderful things about journalism is that you can cover so many different things and be confronted with so many different situations and learn so much about different subjects. And that's just something that very few other professions offer you.
Mm-hmm. And you've found it. Do you find it continually rewarding?
Well, some jobs are more rewarding than others. And, you know, in all honesty, being foreign correspondent in Moscow is more rewarding than being a White House reporter. But, I mean, they offer different things. And frankly, I think actually the way to look at everything is as a challenge, and everything has its own, you know, good sides and bad sides. So. Mm-hmm.
One of the subjects that has a different viewpoint from White House officials and reporters is the role of the press, and the role of the press in, basically in our society. And Helen Thomas, who was here in our last meeting, holds to the view that the press is a surrogate for the public, and that the sessions that that you all have with presidents are the only time that a president gets questioned, and that is a particularly important event in a representative system. The White House does not look upon reporters in quite the same way.
Alas.
But they will have sessions with reporters, although they've changed certainly over the years, and the press conferences have fallen away somewhat. But how do you see it? Do you think of yourself as a surrogate for the public?
Very much so.
And how does that reflect itself in the kinds of information that you ask for, and the way you ask for it?
Well, it's kind of like the way I think about the reader I'm writing for. Mm-hmm. I'm not writing for partisans. I mean, I'm not asking questions on behalf of the Democratic Party or on behalf of, you know, moveon.org or something. I'm not there to present an opposing viewpoint. What I am there is to get the information that somebody who hasn't made up their mind yet wants, so then they can decide what to think and which side to go on. And so I'm always sort of thinking, okay, what would the reasonable but still undecided reader want to know to make up their mind? And that's kind of what the way I think about what questions are important.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I find that people who write letters complaining about the White House press corps often do is they say that they want us to basically, you know, hold their feet to the fire, call them to account, that's your job. And they want us to be prosecutors, you know, to stand up and ask prosecutorial type questions that will catch the president in a, you know, force him to say something he doesn't want to say. And I'm not a prosecutor. You know, I'm a reporter. My information is, my job is to find out information, not to present an argument or to make a counter argument. It is to some degree to get information that those who might want to make counter arguments might want to know, but it's not my argument. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
It does. And so I think people are often confused about what the opposition is. They expect the press to be the opposition, in a sense, if the opposition isn't functioning effectively. So you could say there have been periods, particularly in this administration, when the Democrats haven't been able to get together and speak with a voice or question with a voice or bring up issues, and that the press has been the recipient of a lot of criticism.
And it wasn't our fault. No, the war on Iraq is an excellent subject. I mean, I remember the briefings leading up to the decision to go to war. We would ask questions, but there was no outrage. I mean, it was like there was this void on Capitol Hill. Like, the administration would say things, and no one would kind of step up to a podium afterwards and make the counter argument. And readers and everyone expected us to do that. And, you know, like I said, there are certain questions that it was our job to ask and information that we could ask, you know, ask the administration to provide. But it wasn't our job to articulate the counter argument. And I think that the war in Iraq was, that the lead up to the war in Iraq, the public debate was very poor. But I really don't think that it was the press's fault.
Mm-hmm. When there's a press conference, What kinds of questions in particular do you think of? Let's look at a comparison with the short question and answer. In the short question and answer sessions that the president has fairly routinely, say maybe a couple times a week, that those questions tend to be asked by the wires and they tend to be the hot issue of the day.
Right.
In a press conference, are you asking different kinds of questions? And
yes.
What do you see the value of a press conference as being?
Well, the value of a press conference is that he has to take more than two questions, and these Q&As are rarely more than two or three. And as you said, usually it's the wires, and usually what the wires want is something from the president on whatever the hot story is that day. And, you know, that's their job, and there's nothing wrong with that. The problem is that that's so often all we get. In a press conference, you know the president is going to take 15 or 18 questions, something like that. And one of the interesting things about being the LA Times is that we're almost always one of the last two or three questioners, just the way the pecking order usually goes. You know, the networks go first, and then the New York Times and the Washington Post. And the way the pecking order works is we're almost always one of the last two or three. So your question can't be an obvious one, because the wires and everybody else who asks first are going to ask all the obvious questions. The trick is, you know, not to be prosecutorial, because this administration in particular, and since I haven't covered previous administrations, I don't know if this would be the same, but when they detect what they see as hostility in the question, they get very defensive and also unresponsive. And my job is to get as useful a response as possible, and in this administration, that's very difficult. So the way you ask a question is actually very critical. And, you know, we try to come up with subjects that maybe the president hasn't thought about, so that he might say something off the top of his head that was revealing, like my colleague Ed Chen asked at the beginning of last summer whether he intended to have Vice President Cheney be his running mate again. It was a question that a lot of people thought was out of the blue, but it got that issue on the table right out front, and Bush came out and very strongly said, you know, yes, he's going to be my running mate. And so that was a new piece of information that we didn't know about the administration that wasn't necessarily anticipated. Another thing that I think is important to do is to try to get the president to respond in a thoughtful way to critiques. And the way you do it is not by making that argument, but by asking him, how do you respond to people who say, you know, blah? How would you counter this particular argument, and get him to try to articulate without being hostile and defensive and shutting you off.
Yeah. I remember a question that hi, Bob. We're being joined by Bob Deans of Cox
nice
Newspapers, who I guess you've won the battle with the computer. In one of the press conferences a couple of years ago, Ed asked him about, he was one of the last questions, you're right, and he was trying to get at the feeling that Bush had about the people who had been the perpetrators of September 11th, and he asked them what he wanted for them. Was it justice or retribution? And And he wanted to engage him in a discussion of that. That was not a discussion that the president wanted to engage in, but it was a very interesting question, and I think in some ways it was interesting that he didn't engage in it. That was the kind of thing that some presidents would. I think his father probably wouldn't have either. But it's the kind of thing Clinton thrived, I think, on questions that he hadn't anticipated, that dealt with things other than his personal life. But unfortunately, he got so many questions about his personal life that he cut back a lot on his press conferences. But he enjoyed them. So one of the things you can see in a press conference is the president's thinking. You can measure the president's thinking. We've been talking about getting information from the White House and press conferences. When you're putting a question together for a press conference, what are you trying to tap into?
First, my apologies for being late. Martha understands the risks of bringing working journalists into you, so my apologies as well. I think I'm trying to do a couple of things. One is you're trying, of course, to get the president to respond in an unscripted way if possible. And what I have found with this president is that's very difficult. Yeah. And I think the example you just cited is a very good one. The president did not want to engage in off-the-cuff nuanced splitting over retribution versus justice, and so he just turned away from the question, perhaps wisely so. But what I'm trying to do is to get an unscripted moment from the president and to advance the issue in some way that we haven't heard from him already. In other words, the president has his message points, and any subject you raise, his instinct is going to be to go to those message points. So what you try to do is, if you can, is to come up with a way of turning that chestnut on its ear a little bit and examining it from a different perspective. And you hope that that the president will somehow rise to it, that he'll be provoked into saying, you know, that's an interesting way to look at it. Here's my thinking.
Mm-hmm. How does one get the attention of the president? Because the way the president works, he takes the wires, then he'll take television, then he'll take the majors. Are there ways that you try to get the president's attention?
It's very hard, I find. It's very hard because, for number one, the obvious issues of the day are going to be explored by the wires and by the television. And so you've got to try and be a little bit inventive and to try and come up with a different way to look at the subject of the day, or to come up with a subject that's not on the news necessarily, but you know it's going to be important coming down, you know, mm-hmm. down the road. Someone asked recently at a press conference, for example, Mr. President, how do you expect to spend the money that you're raising in the primary since you will have no primary candidate? And the president responded, just watch me. Uh-huh. That was a concise but uh-huh. insightful moment.
How did you get his attention to start off with? How did you get him to call on you?
See, I think that he goes in there knowing exactly who he's going to call on. I mean, there was this one press conference this last year where the public got very upset because Bush made this, you know, comment about how this is all scripted. What he meant, he did not mean that the questions were scripted. Believe me, he did not know what we were going to say. But he did have a list of who was there. And his staff prepares that list in basically a pecking order. And the president just goes down the list. So it's, you know, all you can yell and raise your hand and yell at him isn't going to make a difference. He's still decided, you know, already in advance who he's going to call on.
They have a chart. I mean, actually, you can see charts. I've found charts in presidential libraries going back to Jimmy Carter. So they know who's sitting where.
Yes.
And they, you know, shuffle the deck a little bit, depending upon you know what the issue is, and every now and then they can have a sense if it's a foreign policy issue, who might be asking a question that the president might want to talk on, and so they might put that person, like in the East Room, they might put them on the corner,
right.
Assign them to a corner seat so they could be easily called on.
It's very hard to get his attention in a press conference. Certainly, yelling out will get you negative attention.
Yes.
He will say, absolutely, I'm not calling on this person if you yell out. And sometimes even raising your hand at an inopportune moment is sort of frowned upon.
This president is actually very big on politeness and decorum, and we're all under, you know, strict orders. All our cell phones and pagers have to be turned off whenever we're anywhere near him. If he hears a cell phone go off, he goes ballistic. He yelled at a reporter. Well, yell's too strong a word. He chided a reporter for wearing jeans to a photo op once when we were on the road. He likes to be addressed with a degree of formality, and he hews to that. And so, you know, yelling at him. One thing that often happens on the road, actually, is that regional reporters will be allowed into the pool or will be allowed to the airport, you know, reporters from the local papers of wherever it is that we are. And they're almost always the ones who yell at him, mm-hmm. because we know better. We know that he'll remember who yelled. And, you know, and he will, if it's a moment that he considers impolite, you know, you'll... Yeah, he remembers these things, and mm-hmm. so you won't get a question later. And it's, you know, so whenever there's sort of something out of turn, I would say 9 times out of 10, it's a regional reporter who doesn't know the protocols.
Uh-huh. Sometimes you can engage him in a more playful way. I mean, once at Camp David, he came off with Blair, and at the end of the sort of structured portion of the pool event where he took questions, I just asked him informally, "Sir, would you take a 9/11 question?" And he said, "Yeah, sure, go ahead." That was kind of nice. I can remember examples when it didn't work, however, though, when we were at the UN, and I was a pool when he had a meeting with President Musharraf, and it was after he had spoken about his Iraq policy just last September in the wake of the war, and I had a question for him on that, and he was not going near that, and he started commenting on my attire and so forth in a friendly, lighthearted way, but it was clear that... no questions were going to be taken.
Well, you were the past president of the White House Correspondents Association, and in that role, you wrote and have talked to the White House about having more press conferences. What was your thinking, and how did you do it?
Well, not very successfully is a short answer. My thinking on it was that the quality of public discourse was being undermined by the lack of access to this president, that the public depends on a certain amount of access to the president to understand who he is, how he does his job, and that we really weren't getting that bare minimum of access, a press conference every 4 months. We were going sometimes weeks without being able to ask him a question in a pool event. And I took it up with Ari Fleischer, who was the press secretary at the time, and of course he challenged challenged my assertion, saying, you know, this president is as accessible as Clinton was. He just does it a different way, which is not borne out by the data that you've collected, Martha. But in addition...
Was that in your letter?
Well, yes. But in addition, I said, would it be helpful if I, you know, put this to other people in the White House? And he said, well, I think it would be. Which led me to wonder whether maybe Ari was advocating for more press access, mm-hmm. But found himself a sort of a lone voice. So I talked to his boss, Dan Bartlett, about it, who gave me a polite audience, but you know didn't appear to respond. So I wrote a letter to Andy Carr, the chief of staff, and I told him, in essence, the fact that you're not addressing these questions doesn't mean that the questions aren't out there. They are out there. They're being discussed on the editorial page and news pages around the kitchen table and the water fountain. And you cannot ultimately maintain a national consensus for the most noble of national objectives if you don't discuss them and address forthrightly the questions that legitimately arise from them. And that was the point I was making. I didn't get a response from Andy Card, and access did not improve. Mm-hmm. I'm forced to concede.
When
thank you for trying.
When you're doing your reporting, we were talking earlier about what image Mara has of a reader. Do you have an image of a reader?
You know, that's interesting. I must say I don't believe I do. I used to. I used to have the image of a guy who was my editor in New York years ago, and he's a very thoughtful, erudite person. I used to try to write for him in terms of thinking of writing a letter to him and just raising it up a notch. I think that's not a bad way to go, but for some reason I don't have that in mind anymore.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I had an editor who said that the ideal reader to have in mind is actually your mother.
No.
I mean, I don't know who your mothers are, but one's mother. And his thinking was, for whatever it's, that you want your stories to be understandable to somebody who's not an expert on the issue and is kind of, you know, kindly and good the way your mother is. So if you can, you know, so you're not filling your story full of jargon. You know, you're making it, you know, clear enough that, you know, someone like your mother could understand it.
My mom's a bone marrow Bush supporter, so that would be bad advice for me to take, I'm afraid.
Do you see yourself as a surrogate, the press as a surrogate for the public?
Very much so. I mean, I do think one of the things that I have been happy about in looking at the press corps is the extent to which the White House press corps is sort of a cross-section of America. We come from different parts of the country. We come from different educational backgrounds. I think that's changing some, but for the moment, it's kind of a nice thing. And I do very much think, you know, I buy totally into the Helen Thomas school, which is, you know, it's not a parliamentary system where the president has to go up on Capitol Hill and respond to questions from the opposition. And we fulfill that role of putting to him and his surrogates the questions that are on the minds of the public.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, one of the things that I have noticed about this administration is that I always assumed that there was something like a dialogue or a back and forth. I mean, that we see ourselves as surrogates for the public. We're putting questions that the public is asking, or that we believe the public is asking, and expecting them to respond to those questions. One of the shocking things for me is to discover, and I don't know whether it's just this administration or previous administrations, and Bob and Martha know this better than I do, but that information in this White House really does seem to go one way. They want to say what they want to say, and they don't really want to respond to your questions. You know, and that was a real shocker to me, that there was no real concern over what your questions were. There was, you know, our talking points and our message, and our notion of communications is presenting our message, not responding to your questions.
I think there was a difference with the Clinton administration. Certainly they had their talking points, as all White House administrations do, but and they had their message they wanted to get out. But they felt compelled to respond to the questions, if for no other reason than self-defense. Now, the personal habits of the president would be a notable exception. In that area, of course, you know, there was precious little information forthcoming until it was forced through
no
the legal system.
No shortage elsewhere.
But I will say this. The Clinton administration took very seriously the idea that if the president's going to be taking questions in a pool setting or a press conference or any other venue, we need to prepare him for what the likely questions are going to be, not simply by giving him talking points, but by providing answers to the questions that you would expect to arise. And that forced them to scrub the policies through that prism, mm-hmm. so that they would have to say, you know, what is the answer if you're going to raise a BTU tax? What is the answer to how it's going to affect this portion of the economy or so? And if there weren't a good answer, often they would send the policymakers back and say, we've got to present a policy that has the answers. We've got to address this in some way. So there's a not only a sanitizing, but there's a sort of almost a Darwinian process afoot here where the policy gets better because of the questions. And so the danger is that if you're not taking the questions, you're not preparing the president for the questions, you're undercutting yourself. You're selling your policy short by not providing them with that exercise, which leads to good governance.
Mm-hmm. Can you see any evidence in this administration of the way in which that has cost them? Particular areas where, because they are so forward-looking with their particular message, that perhaps they haven't listened to problems that are bubbling up.
I'll let Marta think about it for a second, but I think the National Guard, the way the National Guard thing has been handled is a very good example. There seemed to have been the attitude that it's none of your business. And sometimes we do sense that from the administration. We know what we're doing. This is sort of seems to be a Dick Cheney kind of a sensibility. We know what we're doing, so you don't need to know what we're doing. Just trust us. And, of course, that trust has been undercut by the weapons of mass destruction issue. But on the National Guard thing, this seemed to be a situation in which they sort of said, hey, you know, that was old news. It doesn't really matter. Once it did become evident to someone in the White House that it mattered, and they put those papers out, it looked like they had a pretty darn good story to tell. Here's a guy who spent 700 hours in the cockpit of a jet fighter. It's not something you do with a phone call from your dad. I don't care who you are. He did show up for work. He did do meet the requirements, at least according to the National Guard. And when we called the National Guard, they told us, you know, look, it is within the regulations to arrange to make up time later if for some reason you need to be out for a few months, if you arrange it with your commanding officer, which apparently Bush did. So they seem to have a good story to tell of a guy who was, selling sporting goods for $40 a week in a Sears and Roebuck, decided he wanted to be a pilot, and lo and behold, he was one. And you just sort of wondered why the tortured, twisted, convoluted way of eking this information out and dumping it on our desk at 7 o'clock on a Friday night. You wonder how they benefited from it.
Mm-hmm. I think we can go to questions. And let's start. What we'll do is we'll just go off one to the other. We'll do Towson first and then the Washington Center here. Does anybody have a question to Towson?
I didn't quite get the third part of your question, but I'll answer the first two, and then you can re-ask that one. Bush has done the same thing that every president does, which is come into office saying that they're not going to personalize the relationship with the Russian leader, and then they go ahead and personalize it. I think Americans tend, and this is a bipartisan thing, they tend to believe that they can take the measure of a person when they meet them in public. Meet them in person. It's something that we Americans do. And that's why, to understand where the relationship was, you have to remember the very first months of the Bush administration in which they downgraded the relationship with Russia. I mean, Bush came into office. He reduced the status of the Russian director within the NSC. He said that he didn't necessarily believe that all of these nuclear threat programs that were going to safeguard Russian nukes were actually worth the money, and they were going to review this process, and they were going to, I mean, they just came in saying that everything was on the table and the entire architecture of Russian-American relations needed to be rethunk from the bottom up. And the Russians really took offense at this, and the administration didn't care. And so they really got off on the wrong foot. And then they went to Slovenia, and Bush did what every American president did, was meet the Russian president and say, oh, well, he's not such a bad guy. You know, we can get along. We can do business together. It's the Margaret Thatcher with Gorbachev and whatever. Anyway, so... that said, there isn't a lot of substance to the Russian relationship. I mean, I think that there's a fair amount of sort of good feeling between Bush and Putin, and they may like each other on a personal level. I think they probably do, based on the times that I've seen them together. But they don't have a lot to talk about. And the fact of the matter is that in the way this administration views the world, Russia is a very minor player, and that irks the Russians. And that's something that's a fundamental disconnect that has not been solved throughout the relationship. The other thing is Chechnya is an irritant in the relationship. I personally believe that this administration is much tougher on Chechnya than some of the news reports would lead you to believe, and the reason is that there's always secondary channels. Diplomacy is conducted along many channels, and the secondary channels on Chechnya are actually very harsh. And this administration doesn't trust the Russians to deal with terrorism issues. And so one of the reasons why they say nice things in public about the terrorism issue with the Russians is in part not to antagonize them, because in their back channel discussions, they're actually often being very critical. The thing that is dangerous, the way that Chechnya plays a destructive role in the relationship right now is that This administration, like every other government, can look at what's happening in Chechnya and say, this is not a disciplined army. This is not an intelligence service that has a good handle on the problem. This is not a country that is able to conduct the diplomacy with its neighbors like Georgia and Azerbaijan in a way that solves this security problem. And that's something that that they're constantly telling the Russians, you've got to do a better job at this. And cracking down on more Russian civilians is obviously not making the situation better. So I think that Chechnya is off the radar screen for a lot of for most dialogue, but it's actually a continuing irritant behind the scenes in the relationship. And what was your third question that I didn't quite hear? Right. Right.
If there was any sort of empathy flows between the Russians and Americans on the war on terrorism considering the relationship.
Right. I mean, this is actually one of the reasons why I feel so strongly about the use of that war on terrorism issue is that I was in Russia during September 11th, and, Putin was the first guy to express sympathies to Bush. And the reason he did it is that it was immediately obvious to him that he'd won a huge rhetorical victory, which was he now had the U.S. president using the kind of language that he had been using for the previous 2 or 3 years to describe what had been an ethnic uprising. He'd called it terrorism. As far as he was concerned, it wasn't an ethnic or a nationalist uprising. He labeled it terrorism, and now all of a sudden the U.S. president was talking about a war on terrorism. Putin had this rhetorical umbrella under which to continue to prosecute his war against the Chechens, and Bush handed it to him. And this is something that you've seen around the world, that every time, Jean-Bertrand Aristide right now is talking about the armed uprising in Haiti. Regardless of what you think the merits are of the insurgents there, he's calling them terrorists. Anytime some leader doesn't like somebody in their country, what they're doing, he doesn't have to deal with the legitimacy of their claims. He just has to label them terrorists. And that's a rhetorical bind that this administration has put us in, and it means that our ability to react on a foreign policy basis in these situations is very much constrained.
Mm-hmm. Like Rod Paige called the NEA today.
Yeah, that's absurd. Anyway.
Actually, I'd like to ask both of you, you have a specialty in foreign policy. Bob does as well. And I'd like to for you to say what advantage that gives you in covering the presidency, because so much of the presidency really is involved in foreign policy. And generally, the people who come to the White House beat are generalists. Their backgrounds are in political affairs, serving in different beats, like on the Hill, or the it may be a department like State or Defense. And you all come in with a different kind of background. Does it give you some kind of advantages in seeing a president and seeing what's going on with the presidency? Mara, do you want to take it first and then Bob?
Well, I think it was an advantage in the lead up to the Iraq War, certainly. That was a complicated period of foreign policy arguments where people held a variety of views across the spectrum. It wasn't cut and dried. But with this administration, I have to say it's, in covering the White House, it actually doesn't always help because, or at least let me answer it slightly differently. The dialogue, at least in the briefings, is often on such a superficial level, and Scott McClellan steers away so much from foreign policy issues that being a foreign policy expert doesn't really help you. I mean, one thing that this administration does, which I believe other administrations didn't do, is that it refers almost all questions about diplomacy or the military to the State Department and the Pentagon, and it doesn't engage with the White House press very much at all on these issues. And when we call people at the NSC, they're very, very tightly controlled in who can talk to us and when. And because the NSC press operation is subordinate to the White House press operation, they stray very little off of their talking points, and it's just not a useful dialogue often to have on foreign policy. Mm-hmm. If you want to cover the foreign policy that's taking place in the White House, you have to be calling State Department and the Defense Department and people in the policy community, and then going to the White House at some other point. I don't know if you would agree.
No, I would agree with that. And it's also, you know, you really don't have the time, you don't have the resources to develop those sources at the Pentagon and State Department. I can't spend time over at the State Department because I have to spend time at the White House. Where it helps me is with sources and understanding of the issues themselves so that we can go beyond, you know, what we're being told by these people. But I would echo Mara's remarks. It's helpful on foreign policy issues to know, have a little more background maybe than the guy next to you. Mm-hmm. Who will have an advantage over me if it's a political issue. Mm-hmm. And again, a good thing about the White House Press Corps is you've got some people in there. You know, you've got Dick Stevenson with the New York Times who's a tax and budget expert. You've got
great questions.
you've got people who are political folks. You've got foreign policy folks. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the more the better for that mix. We all sort of bring our own. You know, my bureau chief used to say it takes all kinds of different players to make up the symphony. I sometimes think of the White House Press Corps that way.
Mm-hmm. Question. Larry.
I'll tell you what, I'll see to you.
yield to the lady.
Hi, I'm Jessica. I'm from Santa Cruz, and I'm an aspiring journalist, so it's been great hearing you both speak. I'm actually working on a paper regarding post 9/11 journalism. So I'm wondering, Mara and Bob, Mara being in Russia during the time that 9/11 happened and Bob being here in the States, how you have felt that journalism has changed since 9/11. And there was an article that came out in the New Yorker last month regarding Bush's fortress, you know, the information that doesn't get out to the public from the White House. And if you could just maybe comment on that and how you feel that media access should change, if any, in the future.
Well, I would say that I think the main way that 9/11 has changed journalism is that it's changed the public dialogue and that people think differently about security, and at least for a while, that may be changing now with the election heating up, but at least when I came back to the United States, I felt that people were much less questioning of, like, the terminology, as I said, but even of the president. People gave him the benefit of the doubt, and the press really reflects the public. If something isn't an issue with television viewers and with newspaper viewers, we do take cues from what we hear from people. And so if it's not a big issue to people, we're not going to press on it as hard as something that we think is an issue to people. And after 9/11, the public really, you know, gave the administration a free hand in many ways. And the result was that, you know, I think that we may have reflected that. I mean, it's a little hard for me to say because I wasn't here for that first year after 9/11. But certainly in terms of the public dialogue, I think that it changed. And things like impugning people's patriotism and whatever, I don't remember that happening a few years ago. I mean, that's, you know, the whole idea that if you question the president's foreign policy, you're somehow against national security. I mean, since when is the world so dualistic? You know, that kind of dualistic thinking, I don't remember that happening before. I mean, maybe I'm naive, but so that would be my answer.
Yeah, I would say we've seen some of the best and some of the worst of American journalism in the wake of 9/11. I think that's a fair way to put it. My own personal perspective, I was here and I went immediately, instinctively almost, to the White House when the second tower was hit. And a very eerie feeling, I can tell you, to be looking in on what you knew was just the shell of a White House operation. Most of the staff was gone. You knew there were a few, you know, Condi and Cheney and some of the others, you know, hunkered down inside the secure area. and to see, you know, fighter jets circling high over the White House. It was a very eerie feeling. But for me, it was never a, never a question of, you know, donning a, an American flag lapel pin and you know, soldiering forth. You know, we are not soldiers. That is not our role. It is our role to reason why. It is not our role to do and die. That's for the troops to do. And we're supposed to be here on the on behalf of the entire country and the rest of the world asking questions. That is our role. And I determined early on that the very worst thing I could do would be to wrap myself in the flag and say, for patriotic reasons, I will report only the good things that the president is doing, because that, by definition, puts me in the wrong position of a decision maker, of someone who is saying what is good and bad. No, it's my job to report what the president is doing and saying, warts and all, let the American people decide what is right and wrong. It's worked for 230 years, and it'll work now.
One of the, I think one of the points here, too, is that in our discussion earlier about the opposition simply wasn't there. I mean, you didn't have people, like, say, for the Patriot Act, there weren't a lot of people raising the questions in the Congress, and that's not something people can do necessarily. You know, they can't do on their own hook. Do we have a question from Towson?
Well, I work for my editors, not for the White House. And if I didn't ask hard questions, I wouldn't have the job. So, I mean, I'm not trying to make the White House happy. That's not my job. However, it helps me do my job if I have at least the, a degree of respect and collegiality with the people in the White House who have to answer my questions. So I try to be polite. I try not to be antagonistic. Like I said, I don't see my job as being the opposition, so I don't approach them in that manner. But I do try to be, you know, you catch more flies with honey, is sort of the idea. There's no reason not to be, you know, polite and collegial with most of the people in the White House. You don't get very far by being antagonistic. But the you can ask hard questions in a nice, polite tone of voice, and I like to think I've learned how to do that.
Have you had the White House react to any story, either one of you? Have you ever had complaints? Has anybody called, and what kind of story are they likely to call on?
Well, they're very defensive about certain issues, and I'd have to say they're defensive about anything that they perceive as personal about the president. Impugning his integrity. They're extremely defensive about.
No. And what would they call you? They call your editor, and at what level do they call?
In my case, they tend to call me. I don't think they've ever called my editors, but I have heard other newspapers have had their editors called when the White House considers something particularly egregious.
Yeah, I don't think I've had an editor call. It's been with me more, you know, a conversation. And I must say, it doesn't happen often with me that I would get a call. But it is an issue of integrity. They don't have thin skin about a story that, you know, takes a shot at their policy on a policy level. But if you're careless, or you impugn the president's integrity in any way, that's a hot button.
Mm-hmm. Did you find in earlier administrations that you might get a call?
You know, I think I'd say similar. And I think that the Clinton administration seemed to pay more attention to the, you know, to the networks. They would get on the phone, and I heard from my network colleagues that, you know, they would get calls and so forth. Maybe I'm just too low on the food chain. They don't bother me.
Well, I guess it has its advantages then. I guess nobody wants those. Okay, Towson? Was that for Towson? Sorry. Here.
Hi, I'm Ian, and I'm also an aspiring journalist. I had two questions, and they're kind of, one's long and one's kind of short. After 9/11, it seemed like there was pressure to not be questioning the president. That's what I was getting, that, you know, to question the president during wartime was a really bad thing to do. And so I was curious whether or not that had changed and when you felt it had. since 9/11. And then the second question was, it seems like Cheney's kind of out of the public eye all the time, and what purpose you felt that might serve, or if just I'm not watching the right television or reading the right, so, yeah.
Well, I would say in terms of the question itself, we address a little bit, but I think that, you know, every White House uses what they can to disarm you. You know, when the early Monica Lewinsky stories broke, it was, you know, how dare you ask these questions? He's the President of the United States. And that's a very typical response. Mm-hmm. And after 9/11, they had a leg to stand on that. You know, we'll never forget the chilling moment when Ari Fleischer said, you know, we're at war now and people need to be careful about what they say. Very chilling. He later apologized, but it the sentiment was there. And so, you know, there was that sense about it, but I think what the President got out of it was sort of a second honeymoon. When a President takes office for the first time, reporters tend to cut them some slack, recognizing there's a bit of a learning curve. Now, that honeymoon period may last 3 months, it may last six. But Bush definitely got a second honeymoon after 9/11 because people said, wait a minute, we're in uncharted territory here. No President's had to deal with this. We haven't been here before. And we weren't sure exactly, you know, we knew we had to ask questions, and we did. And there were very, very early on there were questions about, for example, is the United States going to sacrifice its human rights policy for this anti-terror campaign? A lot of the more obvious questions came out at that time, and they were forced to respond to them. But I take your point. I think he got a second honeymoon.
I would agree with that. I wouldn't have much to add, really, except that I do think that two particular episodes in this past year have been dismaying for the press corps and for the public. I mean, we're sort of joined at the hip in this way, and one of them is the so-called 16 words in the State of the Union. I think most of us felt, as most of the public did, that, you know, the administration must know something we don't know, and to realize that they were using sourcing that we couldn't really use as journalists even was, you know, pretty shocking. And then just the whole WMD thing, the fact that, you know, that they're now acknowledging that the intelligence didn't say what they were saying it said is a credibility thing. And the press really responds to that. I mean, you know, people can make all of the partisan jabs back and forth and call each other names, and we kind of say, you know, so what? But when, you know, someone tells you something and then later tells you it wasn't true, we traffic in truth. And so that's what we try to traffic in is truth. And that's a very, very, that's something that touches us and really gets to us. And so that's that the administration, I think, really lost points with the press and the public at the same time on that issue. As for Cheney, I actually got some fairly unexpected access to Cheney last month. And what I can tell you I learned about him in that time is that, and other people know this too, but he sort of articulated it quite openly, is that he cares about doing what he perceives as his job in the most effective way possible. And being a public figure does not allow him to be effective in the way he wants to be. And the main thing is, it's not his job to articulate administration policy. That's up to the president and to the press office and whatever. But Cheney's job is to be sort of a behind-the-scenes thinker and to be something of an advocate or a liaison with Congress. And he gets into the weeds on a lot of legislation, making, you know, deals and back and forth stuff and whatever. And, you know, I mean, he said to me quite openly, if I were constantly going to the press with every stage in this process, I would have no credibility on the Hill. I mean, the reason why I can negotiate with people on the Hill and why I can be effective is precisely because I'm not a public figure. So as he, I'm not saying that this is right or wrong, but as he defines his job, he sees having being a public figure as a liability. Now, it may work the opposite way, that being so secretive may become a liability for them in the campaign, and that's one reason why he has stepped out into public more in the last few weeks and months, although I think that I'm just guessing here that their judgment is that hasn't always worked in his favor in the last couple of months, but for whatever reason, that's the way he sees his job.
And I wouldn't be quick to assume that he'll be thrown overboard. Bush has a very close personal relationship with him, and I can tell you this with the highest of confidence. Bush gives Cheney enormous credit for the way the country responded after 9/11, because, you know, for a president, you know, they come in anticipating certain issues. They come in with a policy platform on a broad array of themes, but it's the unanticipated, the unexpected that poses the greatest crises for any president. And Bush's feeling is, that's why I wanted Dick Cheney in my administration, and he has acquitted himself extremely well.
Mm-hmm. One of the hazards of the posture that he's taken is that, yes, he can work behind the scenes, but in a sense you leave a vacuum in defining yourself, and so that your enemies can move in, or your detractors at least can move in and define you. So that if you have somebody like Paul O'Neill, who has done combat with you and is not too happy, then he can write a book with Ron Susskind, and he can let out quotes that give a particular flavor to who he is. For example, O'Neill had a quote from a meeting that they were in, that one of the things we learned from the Reagan administration is that deficits don't matter. And that, I think, is a quote that he wouldn't want hanging out by itself there. And perhaps that has something to do with it, that he's fine, that he's getting defined in ways that he doesn't want to be. And so he's become more public because of that. Okay, we're in Towson. Towson?
Well, I think you're right. I think that the rest of the world does see the United States as being somewhat insensitive to other countries and sees itself as the biggest player on the block, and it is the biggest player on the block. This administration came into office, though, saying that. I mean, if you read what major administration officials wrote before they took office in 2000, they were basically saying that we shouldn't be bound by alliances. And then September 11th played right into that. It reinforced a lot of their version of the world. Dick Cheney in particular saw the world as a very dangerous place, and the United States should not, be bound by alliances, should not have to confer, the way they say it now is give veto power to other nations, that our security is first and foremost always. There are counter arguments to that, but I mean, I think your description of the way it is in the West of the world is absolutely true. And when you hear countries around the world saying that the greatest threat to world peace is the United States, you have to say, gosh, we must be doing something wrong because other people don't see us the way we see ourselves. But those aren't questions that Americans tend to ask about themselves, for better or worse.
Larry, would you like to have the last question?
Last two questions. Journalist students can get two questions. I can get two. Actually, my first one is, this has been fascinating, and I wanted to just thank all three of you for a wonderful forum. Last week, I had the opportunity to teach a leadership class on President Bush's communications policy, and Karen Hughes was my guest in my seminar. And afterwards, I couldn't help but to think, I think the president misses her, but I had no one to ask that question to. And so I'm going to ask both of you, does the president miss Karen Hughes? I understand that she speaks to him all the time. She goes to Camp David. She brings her son and his best friend and all that things. But I think it matters that she's not there, particularly since she's left, a lot of bad things have happened. So I'd be curious, first of all, to get your answer on both of you on that. And secondly, these are both just inside the White House questions. Could you compare for all of us the difference between Ari Fleischer and Scott McClellan in terms of what it's like? Both of those questions, again, I only ask myself. I have no one else to ask, so I'll ask you.
Maybe
thanks.
More diplomatic than I am, so why don't you take that one?
Well, first off, with Karen Hughes, yes, he misses her. I think she misses him, too. I really do think those two were continue to be political soulmates, and it's evident. During the 9/11 anniversary, Karen was up there with him for that entire two-hour period that he spent down in the pit shaking hands, hugging people, everyone who had a family connection to one of the victims in 9/11. And I'll never forget, you know, Karen coming up that ramp and just the sort of look on her face and how moved she was by that whole experience. And he absolutely misses her. It's no secret. The reason she went back to Austin was because her husband was unhappy here in Washington. They didn't, of course, want to make too much of it at the time, but that's what it was. And what I always thought at the time was, what would we be saying if a man were at the top of his game career-wise and he was forced to quit a White House position right next to the President of the United States because his wife couldn't make friends in Washington? And it seemed like a real commentary on where we've come. But in any event, it's not the same thing being by, you know, email and phone connection from Austin and wherever she might be traveling and speaking as it is being next door to the president in the West Wing. Scott McClellan and Ari Fleischer have the identical mission, but the press secretary's job is defined in large part by the person who carries out the mission and their personality. I think that Ari Fleischer was a very bright and intensely intellectually disciplined individual. He was also a very competitive individual. And he saw questions in that light. And he wanted to rise. Ari Fleischer, in his early 40s, still plays hardball baseball. And I think that's a good way to think about him. He saw the questions as pitches. He wanted to hammer them out of the park, but hammer them is what he wanted to do with them. And Scott McClellan doesn't take the questions quite so personally. He is a more affable, personable individual on a certain level. And although Ari had his charms as well, I don't mean to diminish that. But Scott, from the time he was, you know, very young, has been in politics through his mother, who is a prominent Texas Republican. And I was chatting with him just the other day about this whole issue because it's been becoming increasingly contentious in the briefing room in the last several weeks. And we chatted about the fact that, you know, Scott understands it's not personal, and he doesn't take it in a personal vein. And that is a real attribute to a press secretary. My own feeling is Scott's a young guy. What was he, 32 years old or something? Yeah. I mean, he's very young. And I believe that if there's a second term and Scott sticks around for it, I personally think Scott has the attributes to make one of the best press secretaries ever, just because of his personal view of the thing. As he grows, as he matures, as he gains more knowledge, and can be more responsive to the questions.
I'd only add a little bit on Karen Hughes. I'd say yes, of course he misses her, and I think one thing that he misses is that she had a real common touch, a real sense of where people are emotionally. Dan Bartlett is a very smart guy and a very clever communications person, but I think Karen had a you can tell it in her writing. She has a real emotional handle on audiences, and I think that's a personal skill that's very hard to pass on. And I think she helped Bush in that way. He's that kind of person too, many times, but he sometimes needs a little help in, you know, formatting it somehow, and that's what she was brilliant at, is coming up with the right phrase that expressed what Bush wanted to say. And then on the Ari Scott thing, I agree with everything Bob said. The one disappointment that I have had in coming into the White House beat is that I always thought, I actually worked in Washington briefly in the late 80s under Reagan and then under Bush 1. And my recollection is that press secretaries actually, the way that we see ourselves as surrogates for the public, they saw themselves as surrogates for the press. And they actually went and reported things within the administration that we couldn't find out. And so they actually saw it as part of their jobs, up to a point, of course, but saw it that they were supposed to learn information that we would want to know to convey it to us. And I think both Ari and Scott see their jobs more as being gatekeepers, but the gates are closed. And their information is only to that their job is to convey only what the president wants them to say. And so I think they're on much shorter leashes than, I mean, it's just my impression, but my impression is that they're on shorter leashes and that information flow is more or less one way from them to us and not from us to them. In both cases, the way this administration is set up, it is not really in their interest to make us happy and be responsive to us. It is really only in their interest to be loyal and devoted to the president and to say no more than he wants to say. And it took me a little while after I joined the beat. I never understood why, you know, Ari would say things like, I think I've responded to your question, when he clearly had not. And what I eventually realized was he was channeling the president. The president didn't want to answer this. It wasn't him. And at some point along the line, someone told me that the president used to watch the briefing while he was working out. And so he knew the questions that were being asked, and he didn't want his press secretaries to be saying more than they did. And so I think that in some ways we're actually closer to the president than we feel sometimes, because he's being just as unresponsive as they are. I mean, that's just my impression. And so, like Bob, I don't take it personally. They're not answering the questions, not to diss me, but because the president doesn't want them to answer the questions.
I'd like to take a crack at it as well. In the case of Karen, Karen was a staff member who had the interest in mind of one individual, and that was the president. And she knew him very well, having worked with him so long. And she had a sense of when he should be involved in something and when he should not, where he should speak and what he should avoid. And I think he had a great deal of faith in her. And the kinds of settings that he appeared in early on that I think were, you rarely find him in a setting that didn't work well. For example, when they were going to announce the bombings in Afghanistan, Karen and Dan and Scott Sforza, who does television production for them, went around the various places in the White House itself, as well as the West Wing, and they chose a room that was the treaty room that they knew that he would be comfortable in, and that also had an advantage of, through the window, I think the speech was in late morning or early afternoon, through the window you could see traffic moving along on Independence or Constitution Avenue, and that was the message they wanted to send. And she had a good sense of all the different ways in which they were going to communicate a message in a setting that was going to be very comfortable for him. I think the interview that he had recently with Tim Russert didn't put him in a position where he looked comfortable. The whole thing had a sense of being rushed about it, of how the whole thing came about, and I think if she had been there, and I think it's a lot different to call in from Austin than to actually be there, that you have to be there discussing with everybody else to win the arguments, that I don't know that he would have been in that setting, in that interview, in that particular place. On a difference between Scott and Ari, I think one, they have different kinds of strengths. In Ari's case, he has a good sense of policy. And that can be important when somebody's briefing, that one of the things he wants to be able to do is control the room. And he had specialties that that he could use, his knowledge of tax policy and of budget policy, that he could use in a variety of questions to let people know, remember, I'm somebody who has some experience here, and I know these issues very well. And especially in a room of generalists, that he could always, and because he took a sharp tone with people, you know, you could risk getting embarrassed by your questions by having him no more you did. In Scott's case, Scott doesn't have that kind of background. What Scott's knowledge of, and I think his advantage is he's a reflection of the president, just as you were saying. But he doesn't have a lot of different ways of saying the same thing. He doesn't have that kind of experience as Ari did. Ari was able to take his talking points and work them around and say the same thing in six different ways. And that's something that that Scott is not able to do. But controlling that podium is difficult, and he really got beat up the other week over the National Guard, unnecessarily so in a way, because as Bob points out, all of that information really could have been given out earlier in the week. But he had a really miserable week, I think, with it.
Is there time for me to give one example of Ari using his knowledge from the podium? Because he used it on me once, right when he was fairly new in the job, and the budget came out, which is one of the first things that happens in an administration, and John Roberts asked a question about the projections that the Congressional Budget Office had laid out and the discrepancy between that and what the White House was saying. And Ari said, well, you're asking me a hypothetical. That's based on something that could or could not happen 5 years from now. And I challenged him on that, and I said, well, wait a minute, Ari. It's not a hypothetical. These are the actual projections that Congress is required by law to assume that the CBO numbers use. And Ari said, well, if you're saying we can't use projections, you're making an argument against budgeting. Actually, he was the one making the argument against budgeting, but I wasn't quick enough to turn that one around, so he outmaneuvered me on that one. But that's a very good example of someone understanding the intricacies of Washington policymaking.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Certainly appreciate your being here. Thanks.